This is Philosophy Bites with me, Nigel Warburton.
And me, David Edmonds.
If you enjoy Philosophy Bites, please support us. We're currently unfunded and all donations would be gratefully received. For details, go to www.philosophybites.com.
What is sport? What distinguishes it from other activities? That's the kind of question that preoccupies the few philosophers who write about sport. But it's not the kind of question that interests sports fanatic David Papineau of King's College London. He has a blog that he devotes to topics in philosophy and sport.
David Papineau, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Good afternoon. I'm very pleased to be here.
The topic we're going to talk about is philosophy and sport. Why and not of?
Well, there is a subject, philosophy of sport, and it tends to be rather limited in the topics it covers. What's the nature? What's the definition of sport? Why is sport valuable? Should we allow drugs to be used in sport? How do we decide between the sexes in sport? Stuff like that. Whereas I think sport is much more philosophically interesting than that. And what I do on my blog is just look at topics that are interesting both to philosophers and to sports fans, where it's some aspect of sport which makes a philosophical point or some theme or idea from philosophy that casts light on what's going on in sport.
Could you give some examples of the kind of things you write about?
So, well, here's a list of titles that will be on my blog. Choking the Yips and Having Your Mind Right, Mutual Aid and the Art of Road Cycle Racing, Why You Can't Just Decide to Support a Team, Why Test Cricket Runs in Families, and so on.
Seems to me that the topics you're focusing on, so far at least, are either very particular events or types of event within specific sports rather than the very general questions about what sport is and so on. Is that a policy? Is that a strategy? You're trying to move from the particular to the general rather than the way philosophy often works, which is at that extremely abstract level.
I'm just much more interested in these particular topics. I got into this. I was asked to give a talk in a series on philosophy of sport, and I started thinking about the nature and value of sport, and after a while I thought, this is so boring, and I'm going to talk about something I'm really interested in. So I started talking about why did Mark Ramprakash dance down the wicket to Shane Warne in 2001 and get stumped by yards, and that's what got me going on this. I realised there were a whole lot of rather particular incidents and aspects of sport that a philosophical eye cast in a different light, and I thought people would be interested.
I should put this in context for American listeners. We're talking about an important game of cricket when somebody did something very foolish that resulted in them losing their wicket, which is quite a serious thing in cricket.
Well, in cricket, when you're batting in a test match, it's a form of cricket that takes 5 days, you have to concentrate on being fairly restrained in what you do. You bat in a different way than you would at the end of the game, or you're trying to score runs in a hurry, and you have to do this for hours on end. And he'd been doing it fine for about an hour, and then somehow he lost concentration. Though, in fact, what I didn't tell the audience till the end of the talk, which is that it's well attested in cricket legend that Shane Warne, the bowler, the greatest spin bowler ever, had been working on Ramprakash for some while, and he'd been saying to him in between overs, "Come on, Ramps, you know you want to." And he meant, "You know you want to dance down the wicket and hit me back over my head," when that would be a quite inappropriate thing for him to do. And somehow putting that idea into Ramprakash's mind made him lose concentration, and this kind of niggling idea took over his body at a certain point, and he was done.
What's philosophical about that?
This is the theme of my blog post on choking the yips and having your mind right. Sporting performance involves a lot of concentration, often intense concentration. Often sports people are exceptional and successful because they have different minds than the rest of us. They can close everything else out and just focus on what they're supposed to do. You might say, why is that important? A lot of these sports is just pretty much instantaneous reaction. But I analyse it in terms of human beings, including sports people, form long-term intentions. They deliberate about what's the best thing to do, possibly at some future time, and then set themselves to do it. And most animals can't behave like this, they just act in the moment. And in order to make sure that your plans, your intentions are carried out when the time comes, you have to hold them in mind. And I think that applies to batting in cricket. You're holding in mind that you're supposed to be playing defensive test cricket mould, and you've got to keep that in mind, otherwise your body will start responding to some more primitive or less appropriate stimuli, like Shane Warne suggesting it's time to dance down the wicket, and you'll do the wrong thing. So you've got to keep focused on what you're intending to do, otherwise you'll get lost. And there's various things that can go wrong. So choking is where the magnitude of the occasion gets into your mind. You start thinking about, as Jana Devotna once did, I'm about to beat Steffi Graf and win Wimbledon, and you stop thinking about what you're supposed to be thinking about, which is hitting the ball hard to where Steffi Graf doesn't want it hit, and within a few games she'd lost the title. That's choking. The yips is where you start thinking about your bodily movements rather than about what you're trying to do with the ball. That's a rather different ailment. And some sports people, it's not akin to certain kinds of obsession, get into a state where they can't stop themselves thinking about their bodily movements. And in this blog, I say these are two special cases of not having your mind right. Now, you asked what's philosophical about that. Well, there's an awful lot of sports literature on choking and the yips. And it seems to me it doesn't get it right because it doesn't have the background apparatus of human beings are beings who can control their behavior by deliberating and making long-term plans and then forcing those plans to control their future behavior by concentrating on what they've done. This is work done by Michael Bratman and Richard Holton on the importance of intentions in behavior control. And I think a lot of literature is ignorant of this, and philosophers can bring that to the table.
Sports people often talk about being in the flow, and that doesn't seem to me to be a condition of reflective awareness of what you're doing. You're immersed in what you're doing, and it's all going right.
I think the people who talk about being in the flow and that being sufficient for performing well in sport are just wrong. So Hubert Dreyfus is very keen on this account of skilled action. You've got to empty your mind and just trust your reflexes. I think that's a mistake. I think you have to focus very hard. What he is right about is that there's certain kinds of things that you mustn't think about. Sports performers train and train and train, and what they do is they get to be able to do certain things automatically that most of us can't, like I can hit a forehand slice and maybe certain people can't. When I learnt to hit a forehand slice, somebody told me, well, cock your wrist and swing flatter, and I did that deliberately. But what I mustn't do now I've learnt to do it automatically, is start thinking about cocking my wrist, because then I really will hit it into the net or hit it out. I mean, I've just got to think, hit the slice. Dreyfus is right to the extent that you mustn't think about the components of the basic actions that you learn to do automatically. But he's wrong if he thinks that you mustn't think about what basic actions you're trying to perform. That's very important.
So is sport, in this example, just a special case of our intention forming generally, or is it something different in kind from our other sorts of activities?
I think sport is a special case. This is one example of how sport can be illuminating about a general philosophical topic. So there's this general debate about the importance of intentions. Can we understand behaviour as just being directed by the here and now beliefs and desires we have, or do we have to bring in intentions as kind of long-term planning, setting long-term goals? And that's a very general issue, and sport's a very nice example of it. Sport's a special example of it because in a lot of everyday life you form intentions and you don't have to hold them in mind all the time. An interesting comparison is between being a Formula One racing driver and you driving, say, to your tennis club on Saturday afternoon, something you've done 200 times before. You don't have to hold your intention in mind when you're doing it because, to be honest, it doesn't matter too much if you forget what you're doing. I mean, there's time to correct, time to remember you've taken slightly the wrong route. But if you're a Formula One driver, you do not want to be daydreaming when you're zooming around Brands Hatch at 200 miles an hour.
One of the intentions that most competitive sports people have is to win. And another interesting case that you've got on your weblog is the issue about cooperation in cycling. Because in order to win, sometimes you have to share the load of work. But that seems almost counterproductive. Why would anybody help other people who might then go on to beat them?
So this is road cycle racing, which is one of the few sports I used not to be interested in. It just looked so boring, just these people kind of getting really tired, and who could get least tired. And then I was watching the Olympics, and suddenly I became transfixed, and it was the women's road race. I missed the men's road race. The men's road race, the British were supposed to win, and then apparently we didn't win because the Australians and the Germans didn't help us enough, which sounded both puzzling and unsurprising at the same time. But the women's road race was the next day, and I watched that, and about 40 kilometres left to go, 140-kilometre race, four women broke away from the pack and started working as a team. So in road racing, the person at the front has to work 30% harder than the people behind who are in their slipstream. And these four started working together, sharing the load of being at the front. And, I mean, that's normal in road racing. The teams work together like that. Except this wasn't a team. This was four different nations. No common interest at all. And there they were for 35 kilometres working together as a perfect team. And I thought, this is very strange indeed. It turned out it was just a straightforward example of mutualism. So economists and game theorists and evolutionary biologists worry like mad about the evolution of altruism, and there's various different kinds of altruism, various different theories about how it evolves. But this case was an interesting case. So each cyclist was in turn being altruistic to the extent that they were in the front, and what they were doing was helping the others much more than it was helping themselves. And you think, well, why does anybody do something that's more benefit to the others than it is to me? But in this case, in fact, it turns out it's not that complicated. It's not one of those situations where you think, well, either the others are going to do their part, in which case I can free ride, or they aren't, in which case I'd be a fool to be nice myself. This is one of the cases where if I don't do my part, we're not going to succeed. Four people have a reasonable chance of keeping ahead of the pack behind, but three really is too few. So if you could sit at the back, being the fourth one, the other three do all the work, not that they'd let you, but if you could, that wouldn't be any good anyway, because you wouldn't be able to go fast enough. The other three would get too tired. You have to take your turn at the front to stop the other three getting too tired. It's like you're trying to hold a rock up the side of a hill, and each of you can only manage for 5 minutes, and you need 15 minutes to recover your strength. I mean, you're all just going to have to take your turn to hold the rock up the side of the hill. So it was like that. That's an example of many real-life situations where a bunch of people need to cooperate, because if one person pulls out, that reduces the chance of getting the prize at all.
Interesting whether that's actually altruism. It's a sort of selfish interest to share the load. It's not that you're doing it purely for the sake of other people.
Good. So in economics and biology, we distinguish between weak altruism and strong altruism. And weak altruism is where what you're doing benefits others more than it benefits you, but it benefits you too, whereas strong altruism is where what you're doing benefits others and is in fact worse for you than not doing it. And this wasn't strong altruism, this was just weak altruism, but weak altruism is interesting enough in itself. Strong altruism you also get in cycling. Well, I discovered in the course of going into this that the domestiques, the servants, these are the grunts who never get to win at all. They're just team members who pull the sprinters around the course. There's a perspective from which they're strongly altruistic. I mean, they're doing something that doesn't give them anything, but gives the leader of the team or the sprinter in the team the gold medal. That's just in the context of the race, they're not getting anything. Maybe outside the context of the race, they're getting paid. Or in amateur races, they're getting the glory of being part of a team that wins. And in amateur races, that's terribly important. I mean, they're teams that their aim is for their team to win.
Let's take another topic from a supporter's perspective now. You've suggested that you can't just adopt a team at whim to support. Why not?
So this came to me because I'm going to work in New York for a term a year from next year. And when I announced this on Facebook, I said, and I guess I'll become a Yankees fan. And this prompted an anguished email from an acquaintance of mine who said, there's something you must know. The Yankees are the dark side. They are the evil empire. They stand for everything that is bad in sport and American life. And what you must support is the happy, hapless, sweet New York Mets, who stand for all the virtues in life, and all right-thinking New Yorkers support the Mets and not the Yankees. And I wrote back to him. I said, well, that's very interesting. I sympathise entirely with your sentiments. But somehow, puzzlingly, this doesn't make me a Mets fan yet. And I started thinking about, well, I believe what he says. And I can see it's a good thing that the Mets win and not the Yankees win. But I'm not a Mets fan yet. And I realised that to be a fan of a team, you have to be partisan. You have to be partial. And you have to somehow see it to be important, significant that they win and do well, over and above the extent to which this is justified by the objective value of the team. And then I started thinking, but now it's a bit crazy to be a supporter of a team. Let's switch from the Mets-Yankees thing to one where there's no kind of moral issues. Arsenal versus Spurs, right? So an Arsenal fan might pray to God that Arsenal will beat Spurs. And a Spurs fan will pray to God that Spurs will beat Arsenal. And you think, but hang on, now there's something incoherent, because how could God, who sees what's valuable from an objective point of view, think it to be both valuable that Arsenal should beat Spurs and vice versa? But that's what you have to think as an Arsenal fan, and you might think that this says something incoherent in finding it important and valuable and worthwhile that your team should prevail. But then I started thinking, but this is not an issue that's peculiar to supporting sports teams. It's just the issue of agent relative values, about the validity of partiality. So it's important to me that my children flourish. In a way, it's not important to me, I'm sorry, that your children flourish. But from God's point of view, they're equally important. And there's a perspective from which it's puzzling that it should be rational for me to value the welfare of my family and friends and various other things I'm affiliated to over and above other ones.
Well, it strikes me some of this is a bit like nationalism. There can be a good kind of nationalism and a bad kind of nationalism. Let's hope this never happens again. But if there's a disaster at a football stadium, somebody who only saves people who are on the Arsenal fans rather than the Spurs fans will seem absolutely callous. That's the point where you set aside those artificial tribal differences and recognise common humanity.
I think there are contexts where one should respect tribal differences and ones where one shouldn't, but I don't think the tribal differences are artificial. It's perfectly rational and right that people should value things to which they have a special relation over ones to which they don't have that relation. But it's a puzzle about why that should be so. If you think that what's really valuable is valuable in itself, it's a bit puzzling how something can be valuable for one person, not for another. The count of how that's possible that I like, and it's one supported by Bernard Williams, is the idea that things become valuable for you because you adopt them as a goal. It becomes part of your projects. It becomes one of your ambitions. It's very important to human beings. And this goes with what I was saying earlier about intentions, that human beings form long-term plans. They set themselves goals. They have ambitions. They structure their life in a certain way. And I think once you adopt something as a project, then the success of that project becomes important to you, quite properly so. In a way, it's not important to somebody who doesn't have that project. Can I share a little anecdote? This will bring it home. So my son somehow ended up not sharing my project. He's an Arsenal fan. And a couple of years ago, we got a season ticket for Arsenal. I used to go along. And as your season tickets work, you end up hanging out with various other Arsenal fans that you don't know very well. And they were all having these conversations about, what should we do? We really should get rid of Shamak, and it'll all be right when we have Wiltshire back. And I discovered that I couldn't join in these conversations because I couldn't say we. I wasn't part of this group that was scheming and planning and working out how they were going to flourish. And so for all the fans and the supporters, this really is a joint project. They're thinking about how the whole enterprise can go forward, and you have to become part of that project to become a supporter.
We talked about the value of supporting a team, but some people are sceptical about the value of sport at all.
I think sport is valuable. So you need to figure out why it's valuable. So there's a well-known, quite influential account of games, not sports, by Bernard Suits, his book The Grasshopper, where he says it's trying to produce some result via unnecessary means. So his thought is that all sports have rules that constrain you in how you're allowed to get from the starting blocks to the 100-meter tape, or how you're allowed to get the ball over the net and so on. And he suggests that sport is valuable because it involves you in this enterprise where you're putting obstacles in your way of getting at some goal. And I think he's just missing the point. I mean, he's he's talking about games in general, but sports are a special case, is a kind of pure transcendental activity that we're able to engage in when we've... He talks about a utopia where all the practical needs are cared for and we're away from the vulgar necessities of life and we're just going to play. I think he's wrong, actually. I think there's plenty of sports where you don't put unnecessary obstacles in the way. Think of gymnastics, diving. What's the goal? Is to get into the water. I mean, there's no rules about how you get in the water, just get in the water. But what you're trying to do is do it in the most athletic and aesthetic way possible. The same with gymnastics. I mean, the aim and the rules are just one and the same. Look, there's sports and there's games. And what differentiates the sports is that they're physical. So there's chess and bridge and poker, and they're games, all right. And there's sports, and the difference clearly is that sports are physical. I think it's very natural to human beings to develop their physical skills, and they take pride in their skills. That's very natural to human beings. And it seems to me that it's a very natural thing to want to develop certain skills as far as you can, to be as excellent as you can at rowing or running. And a very natural way of testing whether you can be excellent as you can is to see whether you can do it better than other people. And once you start testing, maybe you want to put various rules in place to make sure the tests are appropriately calibrated and can be compared from case to case. But now you have a whole enterprise of activity, and people set themselves goals and ambitions within the context of this enterprise, and now it just becomes the kind of thing that has value because you've set yourself the ambition to be the Wimbledon tennis champion or something lesser. And so I don't think there's anything much in sport beyond delight in physical excellence and the general business of humans setting themselves projects.
David Papineau, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more Philosophy Bites, go to www.philosophybites.com. You can also find details there of Philosophy Bites books and how to support us.